So, my friends, we are going to move on from the seventh commandment today to the eighth commandment, and I'm just curious, off the top of your head, what's the eighth commandment about?
Stealing.
Very good. How about the sixth commandment? What was that one about? All right, murder. What's the second commandment about?
No.
That's the first commandment. Second commandment is graven images. Fourth commandment? The Sabbath day. That's right. Seventh commandment, recent memory. All right. What am I missing? Fifth? Very good. You guys, why is that even helpful to know the commandments by number? Well, if the Ten Commandments are intended by God to summarize everything that He requires of us, what obedient living looks like, what ethical living looks like, then it is helpful to know the Ten Commandments backwards and forwards and by their numbers, because every ethical issue you encounter falls under at least one, and sometimes more than one, of the commandments. There's whole realms of moral responsibility under each of these commandments, and we gather that because of the way the Ten Commandments are referenced in the Bible, but also, we're going to see again today, the way the Ten Commandments are unpacked, even in the Old Testament, after they're given. What I'm doing in this class is something that's done in the Scriptures, both by Moses in Exodus and Leviticus and so on, and by our Lord Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. He takes the commandment and says, whoa, you guys need to know there's a lot more in this than first meets the eye. So we're going to do that again with the eighth commandment now, and this is my object lesson. Why do I carry this huge wad of keys? And this is a special beef of me. The fob on modern cars, I mean, it might as well be a brick. Who wants to carry this? I don't carry a purse. This is in my pocket. This thing is huge. But this whole thing that I carry in my pocket is a daily manifestation of the problem behind the eighth commandment. How?
You're protecting what's yours.
Yeah. From who? Whom? Who am I protecting it from?
Everyone.
I'm not protecting it from you. You love me. Who am I protecting? My car, my house, the church, and, 39 other things that I have on it. Who am I protecting him from?
Robbers.
Sorry? Robbers. Okay, thieves. Yes, exactly. In the new heavens and new earth, I can't wait to see the cars we drive. None of them will have keys or fobs. Think about it. Why not? Because in the new heavens and new earth, no one's going to want my stuff. They'll be perfectly happy with their stuff. Just as a kickoff to this whole subject of theft and its impact on us personally and on our society, it is an amazing fact that millions of dollars are spent in our societies protecting our things from those who would take them unlawfully. The reality of the sin of theft is everywhere you look. Another thing that's not going to be in the new heavens and new earth is personal identification codes and all those passwords that you have to enter and have a very hard time keeping track of. And all of that, there'll be no malware in the new heavens and new earth, and there'll be no cyber theft in the new heavens and new earth, and there'll be no internet security industry that spends millions of dollars trying to protect people's stuff. So we're going to be talking about stealing, but I think you will not be shocked to hear me say that before we go to the most obvious forms of theft, we need to talk about some of the root issues really the root issue behind the Eighth Commandment. And when I say that, I have in mind the fact that we've seen a pattern in these Ten Commandments that each time God says, thou shalt not do this, that, or the other, there's something he's protecting. There's something he's ordained in the world, in our lives, that he's safeguarding. In the Sixth Commandment, he's safeguarding life. Seventh Commandment, he's safeguarding marriage. In the Eighth Commandment, there's probably more than one way of saying it, but I think one of the best ways of capturing, in a word, what God is protecting, what he loves, what he's ordained, that he's safeguarding, is this thing called stewardship. So the person who steals is violating the way God intended the world to be in a certain way. And I'm going to unpack what stewardship is with a two-part definition. Stewardship, in the first place, involves acknowledging that all that we have and all that our neighbor has is a gift of God. That's the first part of stewardship. Acknowledging that all that we have and all that our neighbor has is a gift of God. I left my coffee in the wrong spot. But now I'm back. So the Eighth Commandment cannot be understood apart from this principle that God gives gifts to each one of us in our lives. So, in other words, personal property is basic to the Eighth Commandment. When God says, you shall not steal, that doesn't even make sense if there are not certain things that are yours and therefore not mine. It doesn't make any sense for God to say that you shall not steal if there isn't this reality that God has distributed to each of us various kinds of things. Not just material things, of course. He's distributed to each one of us intellectual gifts. He's distributed to us gifts in terms of our personalities. He's distributed to each of us gifts in terms of our heritage, our families, our communities, the place and time in which we live. He has given everything to us. But specifically for the purposes of the Eighth Commandment, we need to recognize that personal possessions and ownership of things God has given us is basic to the Eighth Commandment. This is in contrast to all notions of, say, a communism or extreme or radical socialism that argues against private property. And you know, one of the arguments that a Christian can make most basically to the idea that none of us should consider any of our possessions our own, but they're something shared by all of us, is the Eighth Commandment. You say, well, the Eighth Commandment doesn't make any sense then, because the Eighth Commandment assumes that there are certain things that are ours, certain things that are mine, and certain things that are yours. Now, let me give a qualification to what I just said. The fact that the Bible affirms private property, personal possession of various things that God has given, doesn't mean that any of us own what we have in an absolute sense. I'm not undoing everything I just said. I'm making this further point. Everything that you have and own as a gift of God is entrusted to you by God to use, to put to good use on his behalf. That's the sense of steward. Yes, God has given you things, but he's not given you anything to do with it however you please. He's given you everything you have in order to make use of it to his glory. So everything you have is something you're to steward. A steward is somebody who is entrusted with possessions of another and entrusted with them in order to put them to good use. The Bible teaches that in an ultimate sense, God owns everything. Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Who's the great possessor there? The Creator is. So, when I start by defining stewardship with point number one, everything that we have, everything that our neighbor has, is a gift of God. I want you to recognize that stealing is an assault on that arrangement that God has made. He's given this to this person. He's given this to this person. He's given this to this person. But when this person sees what this person has and he tries to take it to himself, the problem God has with that is, no, I intended that for him. And I intended something else for you. Do you see how stealing is an assault on stewardship, inasmuch as the individual who steals is rebelling against the way God has given his gifts to men? So stewardship is an acknowledgement that all our gifts and those gifts, probably all that we have and all that our neighbor has, is a gift of God. The second part of the definition of stewardship that I want you to have is that the diligent effort to use our possessions as God has required and to promote the same in others. Stewardship involves the diligent effort to use our possessions as God has required and to promote the same in others. I think there's the idea that can enter our minds that if it belongs to me, I can do whatever I want with it. I'm not hurting anybody else, right? Do you hear that utilitarian ethic now? If it belongs to me, I can do whatever I want with it, because it's not hurting anybody else. If I want to buy a Ferrari and roll it off a cliff, if it's my Ferrari, I should be able to do that, right? If you owned a Ferrari and you had enough money to own 12 of them, you might have fun just pushing it off of a cliff. And I think a certain ethic would say, there's nothing wrong with that. Who can argue? Except maybe the guy who has to clean up at the bottom of the cliff. Maybe he'd argue against that, because, yeah, that does somebody's property. But the problem with that way of thinking is found in the second part of the definition of stewardship. We're to use the things that God has given in a way that pleases him, that glorifies him. Let me put it to you this way. God is the only one who can do whatever he wants with his stuff. He's the only one. He made us, he made the world, he can do with us as he pleases. But we're stewards of his stuff. And so, whether it's our being a good steward of our things or our acting in such a way that we are willing, actually we want to promote our neighbor's good stewardship of his things, this is what the Eighth Commandment is trying to protect. It's what the Eighth Commandment is trying to safeguard in our everyday lives. If you recognize, not only do you have certain things that God wants you to use unto his glory, but so does your friend, then you will not take what he has to yourself. You'll actually seek to do everything that you reasonably can to promote his good stewardship as well as your own. This is a bigger vision for life than might first appear in the commandment, you shall not steal. There's many ways that we can interfere with somebody else being a good steward of what they have. We could take their things, but in addition to that, we could damage their things. We could deprive them of the benefit of the use of their things. And so, in the broadest sense of the word, stewardship is not only acknowledging that what we have, what our neighbor has, is a gift of God, but it's also the effort, the diligent effort to use our possessions as God has required and promote that use in others. What I hope I've done, like with the other commandments, is give a deeper and broader a context for God coming and saying, "You shall not steal." There's something big, and it's actually something beautiful. God's ordained the way that He's made the world and us in it, that He's protecting. It's this thing we call stewardship. Do your churches have Stewardship Sunday? Sometimes that's just code for, we're going to encourage you to give money. Our church has Stewardship Sunday, the beginning of the year, but we are in a pattern of talking about two things. Not just stewardship of our money, and a sermon on that, but also stewardship of our time and our other resources, so that encouraging, in our case, the beginning of the year, encouraging the remembrance that everything we are and everything we have is to be offered up to God in a way that's pleasing to Him. And the eighth commandment is forbidding any kind of behavior, and as we're about to see, even any kind of inward heart attitude that sets itself against this obedient pattern of stewardship. Questions, comments, or snide remarks? Millie? The bow. The bow. All right, I'm going to talk about the heart now. We've done that with each of these commands, and it's because stealing starts in the heart. And it starts in the rumblings and twistings of various kinds of attitudes or even emotions that are what ultimately give rise to the outward act of stealing. So let's trace back into the heart the source of one man taking another man's things. The first thing I want to talk about, this would be item number one. I've run out of board to put all my words up there. I'm going to talk first of all about a little triplet of three closely related heart attitudes that are a root of the sin of the eighth commandment. I'm going to talk about greed, envy, and covetousness. You have heard these words. Sometimes they're used a bit interchangeably among us. Sometimes they appear in the scriptures quite close together, but they do have their distinctive meanings. Greed, envy, and covetousness. The third is, of course, it gets its own place in the Ten Commandments. It's the tenth commandment. But there's overlap between the commandments in this regard. Greed is the desire to have more than what God has given. God's given you a certain set of blessings, a certain set of gifts. And God hasn't given you the same set as your neighbor. As a matter of fact, there's tremendous variety of the kinds and amounts of gifts that He gives. Greed is the continual desire to have more than what God has given. Do you see how that would be a root sin behind theft? The sin of stealing. Somebody who steals wants more than he already has. Who can find 1 Corinthians 5:11 for me? Just Shout it out when you've got it. Greed is distinct from envy. Actually, I need somebody else to look up Proverbs 14, verse 30. And I need somebody else to look up Luke 12, verse 15. You have your assignments? Yes, sir.
I can do
5:11. All right, give me 1 Corinthians 5:11. I think you had an unfair advantage. Electronically.
But now I am writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother, he is guilty of sexual immorality or greed, or if he is an idolater.
Okay.
Long
list of sins. Interesting, isn't it, that he names sexual immorality. If someone is guilty of sexual immorality and they call themselves a brother, don't have anything to do with them, Paul says. We kind of have a category for that. Sexual immorality is really bad. But then the next word is greed. Greed is really bad. It's the root sin behind the eighth commandment, or one of them. Envy. What's the difference between greed and envy? Anybody? Greed wants more than what God has given.
Maybe disliking someone that has more than you.
All right. Excellent. Envy is directed at a person. Envy is resentment felt towards those to whom God has given more. Aha. Greed is, I want more than God, what God has given. Envy starts seeing that someone in your life has more than you do, and you begin to resent that person. Who's got Proverbs 14:30? Justin?
A tranquil heart gives life to flesh, but envy makes it
Oh. You begin to latch on in your mind to that person in your life who has more than you do, or has gifts at least that you don't have. And you begin to resent him or her because they have something you don't have. Envy is the root, a root sin behind theft. Covetousness is the third evil brother or sister of these vices. I won't call them one or the other. That would be pejorative. Covetousness. Who's got Luke 12, 15? Yes, Jared.
And one of the company said unto him, Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me. Can we keep reading?
That's Luke 12, 15?
12,
13. Okay. Look at, give me 15.
And he said unto him, Man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? And he said unto them, Take heed and beware of covetousness. For man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses.
All right. That was where I was going. Covetousness. That's distinguished from greed and envy. Greed desires more than what God has given. Envy resents certain people for having what you don't have. And covetousness is that most focused desire to have something that another person has. So if I covet, I am looking at your stuff and I'm wanting that. So somebody here in the Greyfriars community gets a new pickup truck, say. Well, I've been wanting a new pickup truck. I look at your pickup truck, you're showing it off, and in my heart, there's this yucky, I want that. I wish I had that. That truck is what I'm coveting. I want that specific thing. You see, these are all related, but they have their nuances. Zach?
So if you're coveting what that person has, should that person really be showing off? It's going to cause other people.
Well, here's the thing. If you have a heart that embraces this reality that God gives gifts, and if you love your neighbor, your friend, then you will actually be delighted at the joy he has. And so it's not wrong for us to share with each other what God has given us, because it's right for us to expect that in love, we'll be delighted by that. But I think you're making a good point. It might call for some discernment in love. You get a new pickup truck. Maybe you know a certain person in your life has really been wanting a pickup truck. Maybe you don't lead that person into temptation by going on and on and on. I appreciate the point. Love does keep from... That's a way of keeping the eighth commandment, in that you're seeking not to be a threat to another person's heart surrender to God's stewardship provisions. So these are root sins: greed, envy, and covetousness. They arise from the fact that, if I can put it this way, when God gives out his gifts, he doesn't seek to be fair. Did you hear what I just said? I'm using that word fair in the sense of a five-year-old. When mom is giving out dessert and your scoop of ice cream is smaller than your brother's, and you say, "Mom, no fair. He got more." God doesn't give out his scoops of ice cream in identical sizes. He's just, in that sense, fair in all that he does. But he's not even Stephen, as we'd say. And greed, envy, and covetousness is a heart response to the providence of God in giving out his gifts in differing shapes and sizes. What's the opposite of those three? If greed, envy, and covetousness is one set of heart sins, by the way, that was only number one. If greed, envy, and covetousness is a set, what's the opposite of those things? You could say, what does the eighth commandment require of us? Whisper that again. Okay, a kind of joy, a specific kind of joy. What do we call it when I get rid of this theft over here. What do we call it when each person recognizes God gave me this particular house, this particular car, this particular wife, these particular kids, this particular job, and I'm way okay with that? What do we call that?
Contentment.
Bingo. The thief is not content. But the one who keeps the eighth commandment at the heart level is content. Contentment is one of the virtues that's required by the eighth commandment. Let's move on. Number two, a heart sin. That's a root sin behind this eighth commandment stealing is malice. Malice towards others. You might use the word spite. So, if somebody... By the way, have all of you had something stolen from you at some point or another? Have you? Show of hands, please. How many of you have had something stolen from you? You know, I taught this class for several years as an aging man, and I didn't have the ability to say that I could ever consciously remember of something of any significance at all being stolen from me. I guess I don't get out much. And then it happened. Someone stole a car out of my driveway. Yeah.
I was there.
You were there. Zach, you didn't do that, did you? Really, I mean, it's on me because I left the keys in the car. But they took my car. It was quite an experience. And if you've had something stolen from you, you know what that... There's something you feel rather violated. Somebody took something of value from me. Any kind of stealing involves malice, because the person who's taking what belongs to another person doesn't care about their well-being, and as a matter of fact is willing to impose on them this loss and this experience of being deprived of their things. So that is an act of malice or unkindness. But I'm just wanting to draw your attention to the fact that sometimes the only reason for the theft is to be mean. What do we call it when somebody wants to deprive you of your things, and they don't even want to use it. They don't even want it for themselves. They just don't want you to have it. There's actually a word for that. The destruction of property. Someone steals what you have and they throw it away. It's all about just, they don't want you to have it. Actually, there's probably several words, but one of the words is vandalism. Vandalism is a violation of the Eighth Commandment, because vandalism takes something that doesn't belong to you and it defaces it or destroys it, keeps you from using what God has given you as a good steward. And vandalism is sheer malice, meanness. I think there's going to be a special place in hell for those who write malware, computer viruses. Sometimes they do amazing technological things in order to steal through those programs. And you know what? Other times, it's just to see how much damage can be done to other people's things. That's why I say that malice is another root issue. Just animosity, just meanness towards another human being. Mr. Needles.
So, does vandalism, like let's say a group of teenagers vandalizes something, if they vandalize it, and they're doing it for quote unquote fun.
Yeah.
Is that technically false? Is that technically malice as well? Or is that something else?
Yeah, so great question. It doesn't necessarily register in their hearts as I want to hurt somebody else. But remember, let's say, go back to the Sixth Commandment for a moment. When I go careening through a neighborhood during a school bus hour, I may have absolutely no intention of hurting a child getting on off a bus. But there's a malice by omission. I haven't been thoughtful of another person's life and well-being. I think your point is fair. It doesn't register necessarily in a person's heart. I know who owns this, and I don't want them to have the use of it. But a carelessness about who owns it, a lack of regard for what my actions will do to someone else's property, that's in the same family of heart sin. Good question. Using someone else's property in a careless way. We'll be coming back to that before we're done. What would be the opposite of this particular heart sin of malice towards another that makes us either careless of their property or even destructive of their property? What would be the opposite of that? What's the word we use to describe actually loving our neighbor so much that we actually, instead of taking away their property, we actually add to their property? We give generously. Oh, I just gave it to you. The opposite of stealing is actually generosity. Contentment is a virtue required by the Eighth Commandment, and so is generosity required by the Eighth Commandment, inasmuch as it's the opposite of the heart sin of malice towards others. I like to think about generosity as turning the Eighth Commandment inside out. Instead of out of a lack of love, taking from a neighbor in order to have for myself, generosity is out of a loving attitude, taking from myself and giving it to another. Do you see it? It's turning theft inside out. That's a better way to say it. All right, number three. Heart sin number three that gives rise to the outward sin that the Eighth Commandment is identifying is laziness. You could say idleness. There is one place where this is explicitly connected in the scripture. Ephesians 4, verse 28, Paul says, "He who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with his own hands, that he may have something to share with those in need. You hear him contrasting stealing with working. And there is something profound being connected here. The one who steals is typically looking for a shortcut way to enjoy certain possessions. The hard way to do it is to work your 9 to 5, save your money, and buy it. That's the hard way. The easy way is to just take it from someone else. So much of theft comes from the refusal to gain the possessions that God is pleased to give in the way that he wants to give them to us, through our labor. Somebody has said, idleness is a species of robbery practiced on the common hive by the drone bee. You following that? You can steal from a community, not just a person. Being a lazy, no good son of a gun is a way of stealing from the larger community, because you want to eat, you want to have shelter, you want to have certain possessions, you just want other people to provide them for you. I'm not saying you, this is not true of anyone here, of course, theoretically. So the drone bee, who says, I'm going to let everybody else take care of all the work, but I want a place to put my feet up, is carrying out a certain kind of theft. Have you ever thought about the eighth commandment, you shall not steal, as requiring the opposite of idleness, requiring hard work, industriousness? That's the virtue that corresponds with the vice of laziness. That's why the Catechism of the Westminster Assembly talks about the eighth commandment requiring a lawful calling and diligence in it. That's the opposite of being a professional thief. The opposite of being a professional thief is to have a job and to be diligent in it. David.
So what if hypothetically you didn't have a job, you just invested your money well and were smart about it? Because you can make a good bit of money just doing that.
Right, right. So I hear. It does raise some interesting ethical questions. Let me put it to you this way. There's always somebody saying, you can get rich quick. Do it this way. There's always some angle that's being pitched to any number of people. You can shortcut the normal, hardworking life and get rich quick by this or that set of steps. And a lot of it's bogus, and some of it's actually true. Interesting question. Well, back to your initial question. If someone is investing well and wisely, they actually are working. That is a kind of labor. So investments and the research involved to invest well, that is a noble calling. I won't gainsay that. If you don't have the view that God gives to all of us gifts in order to use those gifts in order to glorify him, then you might actually come to the place where someone thinks, for example, I've got all the money I need to live on. I think I'm going to retire at age 45 and play the rest of my life. Is that a Christian way to think? Does God give you the calling, going back to another commandment, to work 6 days as well as resting the seventh day, only if you need the money? Fourth command don't apply if you don't need the money. Then you can play 6 days and rest on the seventh from all your playing. No, not if you understand God's ordinance of stewardship, that he's given you a mind. You're one of your greatest assets, guys. He's given you a healthy body. He's given you a creative sense, an artistic sense, and he wants you to be a good steward. The talents that he's given you, to use the parable that Jesus gives, he wants you to put to good use. So the person who doesn't need to work anymore, well, he may retire at 45, and I want to know, if I'm his pastor, now how are you serving the Lord? Now how are you working 6 days? Maybe not for money. Maybe as someone who donates their time, but you're serving the Lord with the things that he's given you. Idleness is a root sin, or laziness, and what contrasts with that is being a hardworking person. Number four, root sin. I'll call that wastefulness, though there's an older word for it. Wastefulness, how in the world would that be a root sin of the eighth commandment? The old word is prodigality. You know that term prodigal just from a parable, right? Did you know why that son is considered a prodigal son? Prodigal doesn't mean just wayward in a general sense, though you might think that from as many times as associated with that particular parable. Prodigal means, it's a reference to what he does with the money that his father gives him. Remember, give me my inheritance now. He takes the inheritance, and what does he do with it? Blows it. He squanders it. Wine, women, and song. I think the wine and the women are in there, but I'm not sure if the song is. He is a prodigal son in that he takes what is his and he wastes it. Does that sound like something related to the things we've been talking about? This area of stewardship? Here's a moment in Jesus' ministry that I find fascinating. Jesus has just multiplied the loaves and fishes, and he's fed 5,000 people. He's made this out of the thin air because he has divine power. John 6:12, when they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, get this, gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted. You think, Jesus, it's not a big deal, is it? I mean, you could do that again. Why be so worried about... You know why? Because Jesus was without sin. Another way of saying that is he had a heart to keep God's law as a human being. And wastefulness is a violation of the eighth commandment, inasmuch as it does not put to good use the things that God has given. There are any number of ethical issues that come that arise with this. The Christian church has historically had grave reservations about gambling. Why would that be so? Guys, I don't think it's because there's something morally wrong with saying, instead of taking my $10 of spending money on Friday night and going to Chick-fil-A, I'm going to take my $10 of spending money and get a little game of poker up with the guys, and if I lose the $10 having fun playing poker, oh well, I don't mind. No, that's not what the church has been so concerned about. The church has been concerned about those forms of gambling that involve individuals developing, and it's a very sad phenomenon if you have any exposure to the gambling industry and the kind of people that feed the gambling industry, the kind of mentality, I'm going to take my money and I'm going to try to beat the odds. And I'm going to put all of that at risk with the hope that I'll have riches in an easy, quick way. And at multiple levels, that violates the stewardship principle. Risking, taking such irrational risks with what God has given you, that's not good stewardship. And particularly the mentality that can come, I want to get rich the quick and easy way. That cuts against the grain of God's ordinary way of rewarding us for hard work with wealth. What's the opposite of wastefulness, or the old word, prodigality? Well, it's frugality. That's another old word as well. It's frugality. Somebody who's frugal is concerned that they not put their things, their possessions, to a wasteful use. As I've said, following in Jesus' own example here. The Westminster Confession again, or Catechism, the Eighth Commandment forbids idleness, prodigality, wasteful gaming. That's gambling. Not the Friday night $10 stakes game. I'm not talking about wasteful gaming and all other ways whereby we unduly harm our own natural estate and defraud ourselves of the due use and comfort of that estate which God has given us. We're not only to protect our neighbor's life, we're to protect our own life. We're not only to protect our neighbor's possessions, we're to protect our own possessions, even if it's from ourselves, which is this area of wastefulness.
Does that mean that it's wrong to be a professional poker player?
I've had this conversation recently. What do you guys think? Professional poker player. David?
I mean, if you're a professional, it means you're working. So technically speaking, you're all working a job.
So let's just assume for a moment that the gambling casinos are wholesome and upright institutions. Let's just assume that for the sake of discussion, okay? They do good to the community. The gambling casinos are attended with edifying cultures and contexts. Vegas is a wonderful place to be. Let's just assume that for the sake of discussion, okay? Work with me on this. And in that wholesome setting, in the gambling world, everybody knows that it's all about odds. And the casino never loses, so to speak, as they say. In the long run, the odds are against the individual. And everybody knows that. But every individual going there says, I am willing to play those odds. I'm only using disposable income. Let's just say, assume that that's not wasteful on the part of the individual. Can we assume that as well for the sake of discussion? The professional gambler is probably somebody who has, over the course of time, studied the game, not a dimwit. He or she's pretty bright, and they have acquired over time the ability to counter the odds that are there and to consistently make money, particularly with a lot of self-discipline, which is what most gamblers don't have, by the way. They win a little, they want to win big. A professional gambler could be content with just winning and so on. I would acknowledge that there's some use of his gifts in that context that constitutes labor. I would acknowledge that. Professional gambler. I think you know I have reservations about the whole scene and the wholesomeness of it. But one of the things that I've been talking about recently is this practice that's becoming more and more of an issue and a reality in our culture of day trading. This is individuals who are playing the stock market, and they're typically buying and selling, not just within a certain day, but oftentimes they're buying and selling within seconds. And they're reading the situation of what's happening in the, and they're buying, hopefully low, and selling, hopefully high. And there's a lot of people making a lot of money, and there's a lot of people coming to ruin. It's both. Now, I think that raises some ethical questions for Christians, because that kind of situation of trying to know when to buy, when to sell, in that short, that begins to resemble the world of gambling in certain respects. However, I acknowledge there's also a great deal of self-education, a lot of professional expertise that is acquired. This becomes a part of a much bigger question that even non-Christians in our culture are grappling with. Are there ways in which that phenomenon of day trading, not just with regard to the individual, but the effects of that on the culture as well, are there ways in which that's parasitic on our larger culture? And are there ways in which that actually does, in an aggregate form, in a larger way, deprive other honest investors of the reasonable value of their property because it makes the market do this and so on. I this is above my pay grade in many respects, but Joseph.
So there are a lot of banking companies and investment companies, whether it's like mutual funds or just like day trading in and of itself.
Right.
So banking and they don't really produce anything. It's all like management of money, and like the Bible talks about too much interest.
Usury.
Right. What would you say about like banking companies and stuff like that, even if they don't have a ton of interest, because like they're a large part of our economy.
Yeah. So guys, you're beginning to see that this is a commandment that has a tremendous amount to say to this whole world of business that we live in. The world of business is the world in which theft of a high order, and oftentimes a very sophisticated and subtle kind, can take place. We'll talk about the notion of insider trading. That's not a kind of theft that I think was facing Moses at the time of the Ten Commandments. But insider trading is a way of defrauding investors who have no way of knowing what you know as someone inside the company, and you sell because of the privileged information you have, and the little old lady who's invested her retirement savings in that company down the road, she's deprived the value of that because of your actions. That becomes societal and institutional forms of theft. We got off on this by talking about the wastefulness that can be at stake in various kinds of gambling or other kinds of professional stock market investment. I can't nail down all the questions on this. I think I want to say that the principle of stewardship is so important to embrace. God has given us each his gifts to be used for his glory, and getting the heart issue of the Eighth Commandment straight is the most important guide to some of these really complicated questions. Is it okay for me to spend my money in Vegas or to take a job with day trading? Is it okay? Get the principle in your heart and head first. All right, let's move on. I want to look with you at a couple of things from the Old Testament that I think still speak very profoundly to our day. And that's what I'm calling the biblical remedy for theft. Turn to Exodus chapter 21. And I'm going to have to be brief for the sake of time. But I want you to have this word in your minds. If you can read it. The word restitution. When you think of theft in the Bible, and in particular the way in which God's law in the days of Moses remedied that, you should think of restitution. Turn to Exodus 21. We're going to look at Exodus 21 and Exodus 22. Just to remind you, what was, remind me, what was the penalty for murder in the Old Testament? It was death, very clearly. Capital punishment for murder. The penalty for stealing, which is what I'm calling the remedy, the penalty for stealing in the Old Testament was this thing called restitution. Restitution is the word we use for compensating someone for the loss that your actions inflicted on him or her. Compensating someone for the loss that your actions inflicted upon them. So, for example, there's in the Old Testament both simple restitution and compounded restitution. What do you think those two words mean? What's simple restitution? You have to give it back. That's right. If you take an ox from your neighbor's barnyard, restitution is you have to give it back. That would be simple restitution. But there are certain circumstances in which the law provided for compounded restitution. All right. Let's look at this. Actually, simple restitution in the Old Testament was not provided for in the area of theft. It was provided for when you accidentally damaged someone else's property. You, for your carelessness, was guilty of behavior that damaged somebody else's property, and you have to make it whole, make him whole, restore what he lost. So Exodus 21, verse 33. This is an example of carelessness. When a man opens a pit, or when a man digs a pit and does not cover it. I don't know why he's digging a pit. Don't ask me. Okay. And an ox or a donkey falls into it. The owner of the pit shall make restitution. Sorry, shall make restoration. The concept here is restitution. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead beast shall be his. There you go. Simple restitution. I had a live beast. Now it's a dead beast. I did not want barbecue. I did not want steaks. I wanted an ox. So now you have the steaks, and I have a live ox. That's do you hear the equity in that, the fairness in that? It could be a complete accident. Look at verse 35, not just carelessness. When one man's ox butts another's so that it dies, presumably this was not a dehorned ox, then they shall sell the live ox and share its price, and the dead beast also they shall share. So why are we talking about? This is laying out in these sample cases. These are sample cases or case laws. What's the way in which an equitable arrangement looks like when your actions or your irresponsibility has caused a loss for someone else? These things continue. Verse 36, or if it's known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has not kept it, he shall repay ox for ox and the dead beast shall be his. It even applies when someone borrows something. If you borrow something from someone else and you break it when you're borrowing it, Exodus 22 verse 14 makes clear you now owe that person what you borrowed from him. I'm sure this was intuitive to you when it's happened to you. It's probably happened to all of us. You borrowed something and you damaged it when you were... Now, your friend might say, no, don't worry about it. And he can let you off the hook. But the hook you're on is, I I broke something of my neighbor's. I need to compensate him for that. Compounded restitution. I want you to follow now as the Old Testament lays out the just and equitable way to punish the person who has not accidentally but intentionally deprived someone else of their property. Look at Exodus 22, verse 4, and we'll look also at verse 7. Here's examples of double restitution. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it's an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. This was an intentional theft of part of my livestock. My neighbor has stolen and it's found. He has to give it back. And he has to give back the same amount. Double. He has to double what he did. Found in verse 7 too. If a man gives to his neighbor money or goods to keep safe and it's stolen from the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. Here's the justice of that in the Old Testament. The law's principle is, as you sought to do to your neighbor, so it will be done to you. You sought to deprive your neighbor of what he had. The law's sense of equity is, not only will you have to give back what you stole, but as punishment for what you stole, you have to give back the same amount. That's called double restitution. There are certain circumstances in which it becomes not double, but fourfold or fivefold. What would warrant that? Well, sometimes the crime of theft is not an impulse, a crime of passion, whatever. It's actually part of a racket. It's part of a way, it's professional. Look at verse 22, verse 1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, you see what's happening? He shall repay five oxen for an ox and four sheep for a sheep. You know what a chop shop is? People steal a car, and sometimes they're this good. Within hours, that car is in parts, and it's being sold for the parts. That's a professional operation. I call this grand theft oxen, that's being spoken of here in Exodus. These are people who are stealing, butchering, selling. And the law recognizes the greater heinousness of that kind of stealing. It's professional kind of stealing. And that kind of stealing is punished more severely in the Old Testament, I think for reasons that you'll find quite intuitive. Now here's the point I want to make. This, the wisdom behind the law in this respect is that the one who is guilty of theft is required by the law to restore what he's taken, even to restore above and beyond, so that there is a restoration for the person he's victimized, and there is a process by which he pays the penalty for his own sin. I want you to compare that with our modern approach to dealing with thieves. How do we deal with thieves? We put them behind bars. So here, get it. The thief, in some way or another, has taken from society, and as a consequence, we put the thief in a place where society now cares for him, provides for him room, board, sometimes entertainment. I'm not saying jail is a great place to be. I'm not saying that. But we have, in our society, a way of dealing with theft in which the thief who has taken from society is now put in a place where they can't do anything profitable for society, and society actually has to provide for them. I want you to appreciate in all the strange language of the Old Testament talking about grand theft oxen and so on, the wisdom behind the Word of God in this particular area. Remember what the wee little man in the New Testament, Zacchaeus, said? We actually don't know that he was little, even though that's the song. He climbs up in a tree in order to see Jesus. But, you know, in certain circumstances, a 6'4" guy could have to climb a tree just because there's a lot of people. But anyway, Zacchaeus, when Jesus says, I want you to put me up for lunch today. He says, behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. What he's saying is, I've been conscientious. You know what? Zacchaeus was aware that there are so many ways in business in particular to defraud or to steal from our neighbor. And he was aware that the moral response to that kind of sin is to do this thing called restitution. I don't have any sense that our society is going to move in that more biblical direction anytime soon. I don't. But the people of God could be thinking in those terms. The people of God can be acting in those terms. Guys, be careful with other people's things. The issue of stewardship is in play. Be careful with your own things. Be careful with other people's things. Sometimes the things that you're using belong to not a person with a face, but an institution. You go to a hotel. How you use that hotel room. There's no face. I remember the account of a CEO of a company that owned lots of hotels. He was being interviewed, and I remember nothing from the interview except this last closing comment. The person, just sort of in a fancy, said, what would you like the average person who stays in a hotel room to know as the owner of all these hotels? And he said, the shower curtain belongs on the inside of the tub. You know what's behind that comment? People who don't give a rip about the room, they don't care about where the water from the shower is going and the potentially millions of dollars of damage that's caused. You know what? It's easy to be that way when we're using other people's things and we don't know who they are, right? There's no specific name. When you're sitting in your car at the stoplight and you see the person in front of you throw their cigarette out into the median. Oh, those are moments where I have wanted to get out of my car and walk up to that cigarette butt, pick it up, and toss it back in his car. That's my fantasy. And I'll probably die doing it if I ever do that. Who knows? But who is that person? Whose possession is that person damaging? Well, in no one particular person, right? It belongs to all of us in a sense. And so it's easy to be careless with other people's things when you don't know those people, or when it belongs to people that you couldn't possibly identify. There's so many of them. But stewardship, the principle I'm trying to drive home this morning, is the fundamental heart set. I want to be a good steward of everything God has given me. And I want to help my neighbor, even if I don't know him, my community, to be a good steward of the things that God has given to him, her, or them. That'll be sufficient for today. I won't get to number 4 today. I wasn't sure that I would. So, guys, have a great spring break. Looking forward to seeing you on the other side.